Chapter 30.
Son of a bitch! Jackson shouted as they all gaped at the screen. They nuked them! They fucking nuked them!
Rossetti spotted the tiny black shape of an interceptor tumbling away from the enormous white star that had been Rodina Station. Out of control, but still in one piece as it disappeared. While Jackson and everyone else was focused on the screen, he helped himself to another pill. These were supposed to be the longest-lasting dosage, but he was burning through them in half the usual time thanks to elevated adrenaline. Well, that and the uppers in the time-released patches under his shirt, but he needed those to counter drowsiness from the painkillers.
I don't believe it! I don't believe it!
Jackson was saying. Her voice had gone up half an octave, and the beam of her light pen was sweeping around the room like a hysterical searchlight.
They called for help, and their own people nuked them! Their own people!
I suspect Rodina told them to, Bishop said. Rossetti had been thinking the same thing himself, but the civilians looked horrified by the idea.
Oh, yeah?
Jackson turned to him, looking ready to panic.
What if we're next? What if they nuke us, too?
They won't, Bishop told her. They're leaving. He gestured toward the screen where the ship was already leaving orbit around the white star that had been Rodina Station. Even on the screen, it was still almost too bright to look at. Poor bastards, Rossetti muttered.
No shit!
Jackson's voice took on a bitter quality.
And to add insult to injury, they violated the fucking arms treaty with that nuke.
Rossetti resisted the urge to explain that the moment Weapons Division had gotten hold of the alien cells, the treaty had become the punchline to a very unfunny joke. At a time like this, civilians didn't need the truth. They needed something to do.
Send the Kansas City another Mayday, he told Jackson. Unencrypted.
Unencrypted? Jackson said. What the fuck for?
In case nobody heard us the first time. Just do it, he added as she started to answer.
Jackson wasn't deterred.
And what if the Nikolai Stoiko intercepts it? She said. They might come back and rescue us too.
Rossetti shook his head.
The UPP would never waste ammo on us.
Jackson hadn't noticed the interceptor, and Rossetti decided not to mention it. The spacecraft would still be intact, interceptors were sturdy, but exposure to that much radiation was a death sentence for anyone in it. They might not last long enough to reach Anchor Point, and even if they did, the interceptor wasn't big enough for everyone just in this room.
Send the Mayday, he told Jackson. That's an order.
Rossetti could practically see her mind working while she decided whether to continue arguing with him. Then she turned back to the console. Now that the mall was empty, Walker couldn't help thinking how banal the place was. Not just merely banal, but really most sincerely banal. He drifted past a jewelry shop. The window display was undisturbed, but inside he could see at least one case had been tipped over and smashed, leaving shiny bits scattered all over the floor.
The high cost of banal living, Walker said aloud, then frowned. He really wasn't himself today.
As an engineer, he'd always thought in terms of applied knowledge. If it wasn't useful, it wasn't knowledge. It was clutter. His job was figuring out what to do and how to do it, not wondering what it meant. Engineering wasn't fuzzy or vague. It had clearly defined parameters. Some things were possible, some were not possible, or in some cases, not possible yet. All based on matters of fact, not opinions or feelings, or worse, politics. One very significant fact Walker had learned in the past 24 hours was that some kind of weird alien infection had turned a lab tech into a monster hell-bent on killing anyone it met. Fact number two. No one seemed to know exactly how it spread. Fact number three. No one knew what to do about it because they hadn't defined the problem clearly enough, despite their witnessing the results of infection. And that brought him to fact number four, which would determine the outcome. No help could reach them quickly, unless what had happened to Rodina Station qualified as help. Walker had managed to pick up a spy drone feed on his Flexi just long enough to see a warship obliterate Rodina Station. The video had been grainy, but no less horrific. He could only imagine how the bunch in Ops had reacted to it on a larger screen in true def. Even Rossetti must have blanched,
and Jackson was probably still going bugfuck. But then, she'd been halfway there already, ever since he and Hicks returned from the construction area. He hadn't liked seeing Jackson like that, which was partly why he hadn't checked in with Ops after saying he would. Even if he'd wanted to, though, comms were spotty all over Anchor Point. Old-school radio would work, but only over short distances. Ops was well out of range. Video was also down, just about everywhere, but that wasn't the worst part. According to the last status update on his Flexi, one of the air scrubbers was completely offline after catastrophic damage, although the update hadn't specified what that was. And it didn't matter anyway, because the clock was ticking. The other scrubbers could carry the extra load for only so long before they broke down. Lack of oxygen would make everyone too stupid to realize anything was wrong until they started passing out, and by then they'd all be too stupid to care. Would that be fact number 5 or fact 4.1? He would decide later, if he was still around. Still, this rather grim outlook hadn't kept him from using his time constructively. His first stop after leaving Ops had been the large machine shop. The place was deserted, but there were plenty of heavy loaders recently overhauled and in good working order. Walker had tweaked their programming, given them new assignments, and paired each one to a remote control before turning them loose. He'd logged a lot of hours working on heavy loaders, making them stronger and more durable, improving their joints for better range of motion. As far as he was concerned, there was no such thing as too many heavy loaders, although he was pretty tired of all the remotes hanging around his neck, clacking against the pulse grenade stashed in his vest. No help for it. He'd run out of pockets. And speaking of a place for everything, he was standing in front of a bar. It wasn't the first one he'd seen since leaving Ops, but now his energy was starting to flag. After a day like this, he could use a drink. Or six. And as everyone knew, it was always happy hour somewhere in the universe. He recognized the football game running silently on the back wall, Brazil versus Haiti in the playoffs, whatever year that had been. It seemed like every sports bar at Anchor Point ran that one on infinite repeat, but nobody ever seemed to give a shit. Now there was nobody but him, and under the circumstances, he didn't give a shit either. Turning away from the soundlessly cheering crowds, he put his rifle on the bar and went behind it to survey the available stock. The remotes hanging around his neck dangled heavily as he bent over to open a refrigerated case. Annoyed, he was about to take them off when he spotted a 2-liter jug marked margarita mix. Gotcha! Grinning broadly, he set it on the bar and found an unopened bottle of his favorite premium tequila sitting on a shelf in front of the mirror. He poured it into the jug, shook it vigorously, then sampled the results. Damned good for an amateur mixologist, he thought, and raised the jug to toast his reflection. Drink enough of this, and he might watch the whole game and see who won before he passed out. The level in the jug was 4 centimeters lower by the time he wandered over to the pool tables. One of them had the standard green felt, the other was bright tangerine. What the fuck, he said, revolted, and had another long pull from the jug to reinforce his amiable buzz. Pool tables were supposed to be green. Only a sick son of a bitch would think of making one bright or... Behind him, something shattered on the floor. Walker stared at the perverted tangerine felt, hoping it was just a clumsy new customer. But even after this much tequila, he knew better. Then he heard the crunch of broken glass and a long, obscenely wet hiss as he turned to see the thing blocking the entrance. Light from the soccer game glinted off its hard black skin as it turned its eyeless, misshapen head from him to his pulse rifle on the bar and back again. The steely jaws parted to let the second set of teeth emerge, dripping with thick saliva. "So who did you used to be?" Walker asked, sidling a few steps toward the bar. The alien shifted with him, snapping those extra teeth at the air. All right, so the creature wasn't as dumb as a box of hammers. He drew himself up, one hand on the corner of the tangerine pool table. "My sainted mother, God rest her sweet soul, always said, 'Have a plan B,' he informed the alien, looking down at the remotes hanging around his neck. The one he wanted was right on top of the others. What a beautiful pain in the ass, he thought, holding it up. Here's looking at you, motherfucker. He chuckled and thumbed the largest button.
The power loader crashed through the bar's flimsy painted facade, shattering the windows and the ersatz neon signs and making the floor shake as it stomped toward the alien. The creature lunged at it with an enraged scream. Walker didn't have to look at the control to make the loader grab the alien and slam it to the floor, which shook again under the impact. Still screaming, the alien lashed its long tail around, clawing at the loader, leaving long scratches in the metal. Walker made the machine keep one heavy square foot on the thing's lower body while it took hold of its neck and pulled. He beamed with tequila-enhanced pleasure as the alien's screams cut off.
As my sainted mother also used to say, fuck you.
The loud hiss of acid blood eating through the carpeting and the floor filled the air.
Jesus, that stuff really was murder, Walker thought, watching the loader's foot melt away into the dead alien's guts.
Holes appeared everywhere the acid blood had splashed on the metal body and grew larger with unsettling swiftness. Seconds later, the machine broke into pieces and a sharp poison chemical stench filled the air, growing stronger and more unpleasant by the moment. Walker decided the atmosphere in the bar had definitely gone to hell. It was time to drink up and get the hell out. He would radio ops as soon as he was in range and tell them all about the new use he'd found for heavy loaders. As he turned away and raised the jug for another hearty pull, his arm gave a sudden, violent jerk. The jug flew out of his grip and landed on the tangerine pool table, spilling the best margaritas he'd ever had all over the obscene felt. He tried to reach for the jug and couldn't. The muscles in his arm were squirming, like he had a bunch of snakes under his skin trying to get out. Walker opened his mouth to scream and instead heard himself whoop loudly, trying to take a breath. The pain hit like an electric shock and refused to let go. His mouth opened wider and wider until he felt his jawbone dislocating, but he couldn't make it stop, couldn't stop shaking, twisting, jerking. On the back wall, the soccer fans were going crazy, screaming, hugging each other, delirious with joy as if they'd witnessed a miracle before they suddenly slid out of sight. Walker barely felt the impact when he hit the floor, tried to reach for a chair to pull himself up, but his arm was flailing crazily, almost as if he were waving back at the ecstatic crowd. Abruptly, he felt himself stiffen, and another bolt of pain hit him as the skin on his hands split open, revealing something black and shiny with blood underneath.
And to quote my sainted mother's last words, Walker thought, fuck me.
It was dusk in Pocket Madagascar when Spence finally pulled herself together enough to think about feeding the lemurs. No one else had come in while she'd been there, which was highly unusual. Anchor Point's eco pockets were as popular as the malls. They relieved the homesickness for planetary life, which was an inevitable part of living in space. Sooner or later, even the nerdiest lab rats got a yen to go outside and play, and virtual reality was no substitute. Of all the pockets on Anchor Point, Pocket Madagascar was the perennial favorite. It had to be the lemurs, Spence thought, although she knew she was biased. Tully had made them for her. She went to the food storage area, feeling guilty. Not that the little primates would be starving. They foraged for flowers, leaves, tree bark, and sap. The largest part of their diet, however, was fruit, which had to be supplemented from the hydroponic gardens. There wasn't enough room here for cultivation. Normally, the caretakers would have already put out a few baskets for the troops. It amused her no end that a group of lemurs was called a troop. But none of them had come in today either. That was even more disturbing. They'd never have just abandoned the little primates. The storage bins in the largest shed were still close to full. She filled two wire baskets, then left the bins closed, but not locked, and the shed door open so the lemurs could feed themselves, just in case. But if no one came back before the bins were empty. Spence shut down that line of thought before she fell apart again, telling herself to get functional, now. Feeding the lemurs would help, and it was the right thing to do. Better than just hiding in here from aliens that took over people's bodies or wrapped them in cocoons. No, she wasn't thinking about that either. She was feeding the troops. Carrying a basket of fruit in either hand, Spence marched across the meadow in the last light of the pocket sunset. The forest was already dark, but she had been there many times at night. She paused to take the flashlight from her pocket and turn it on, angled the head at 90 degrees, then stuck it in her waistband.
not because she was nervous, but to avoid tripping over a root or a stone, she told herself as she kept going, albeit more slowly, making a noise to tell the lemurs she'd brought food. She stopped again beside a large tree, listening for sounds of movement, but there was nothing. No branches creaking or leaves rustling, not even insect noises. Maybe the wildlife could sense something was wrong out there in Peopleville. Placing one basket at the foot of the tree, she made the noise again. Still silence. These lemurs had been tweaked to be less nocturnal than their earth cousins, but they didn't go to sleep this early. The woods should have been alive with the sounds of them chattering and calling to one another. There was a cold, hard knot in her chest as she took the torch from her waistband and shone the beam around the trees, looking for a low branch where she could hang the other basket. The lemurs would have fun with that. They should be having fun now. Maybe she'd spooked them. Yeah, sure. That was it. Primates were sensitive to humans, and they'd be especially sensitive to her because she came here so often. It would be completely normal for them to pick up on her emotions. Here in Pocket Madagascar, there was nothing but normal. Nothing like the thick black blob on that tree a few meters to her left. Or the pearlescent black cocoon above it. Or the one on the tree behind that, or any of the others she now saw all around her. All those lemur-sized cocoons, made to leave those little lemur chests uncovered so as not to impede the lemur-sized aliens that would burst out of their bodies. Maybe they'd come out with cute little rings on those vicious snake-like tails. Something gave a high-pitched shriek and dropped down on her, hissing furiously and trying to claw her face. No! Spence wailed and batted the thing away, adrenaline giving her strength enough to hurl it several meters away into the underbrush. The creature popped up immediately, hissing louder. The grotesque long head was covered with patches of gray and white fur, and the second set of teeth extended from its jaws were all fangs. It raised its furry arms, showing its talons and whipping its long tail around, shredding the flora to pieces as it prepared to leap. No! She wailed again, hurled the basket of fruit at it, and ran for her life. The beam from her flashlight swept around crazily as she tore out of the forest and across the field of tall grass under the rising fake moon. At the exit, she caught a glimpse of several long tails scything through the grass, a glint of steely teeth and deformed eyeless heads covered with fur only seconds behind her. Then she slammed the door. She cried as she used the credentials on her dog tags to enable the permanent emergency lock, but not because she was afraid. This time her tears were for her own foolishness, for running away from Ops, for believing nothing could be worse than what had happened to Tully. And the creatures had rings on their tails.